This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida leads the country in drowning deaths of children ages 1 to 4. This week, the YMCA of Central Florida is offering free swimming lessons at some of its locations across six counties. To find out more about the effort to boost water safety, I paid a visit to three-time Olympic gold medalist Rowdy Gaines, vice president of aquatics at the YMCA.
Hi, I'm Rowdy Gaines, and I am the vice president of aquatics here at the Central Florida YMCA, and we are at kind of the center of the universe when it comes to swimming in Central Florida especially, and it's the Rosen YMCA Aquatic Center here in Orlando. We have three bodies of water in this facility. We have 1.5 million gallons of water. We have a teaching pool where all our swim lessons are held. We have the competition pool, which is a 50-meter Olympic-sized pool where we have swim team and water polo going on, and then we have our dive well, which is right behind us, with a 10-meter official Olympic platform. Our Olympic coach, Mark Ruiz, who was a two-time Olympian, is our coach. We have synchronized swimming going on. We have our Special Olympic team going on. So you come here on a normal average day, and there's 300 or 400 kids in the water from anywhere from 4 to 8 p.m. at night. So it's a pretty special place when it comes to water. It
must get quite noisy.
Yeah, it does. It gets really noisy in here in the afternoon, because you've got all these coaches doing all kinds of different things, and they're all going on at the same time. And it warms my heart, the noisier the better, because I know that there's 300 or 400 kids that if we didn't have this great facility, I'm not sure what would happen. I'm sure a lot of them would go elsewhere, but most of them probably wouldn't be able to, because this is a one-of-a-kind of a facility like this. So we're really proud of it.
Rowdy, people know about your Olympic pedigree. Who else has come out of this particular training center here as far as competitive swimmers and divers and people into aquatic sports?
Well, first of all, as I said earlier, our head diving coach, who has won, I think, the last three national championships, his name is Mark Ruiz, who dove for the United States in two different Olympic Games in 92 and 96. So he's been here since he was a kid. He literally was born and raised in this facility, so he's kind of a homegrown Olympian. We've had so many different Olympians pass through this facility. If you look at our record board, it's literal who's who has competed here. Michael Phelps, Katie Ledecky, Missy Franklin, all the greatest swimmers in history have at one time or another passed through this facility to compete. And we're hoping in the future that we have more Olympians, but we've had several athletes go on to college scholarships in all the sports, and that's something else that we're really proud of.
Does Florida have something special when it comes to training and nurturing Olympic athletes or competitive athletes in water sports?
Well, I certainly think that from a place of where water is part of the fabric of who we are as a community in the state, here in Central Florida especially, water is who we are, and it certainly lends itself to excellence in the water, whether it's swimming or diving or water polos, have you. And I think this is it, because again, in Florida, it's pretty much a year-round sport. I mean, this place is just as busy in January at 4 o'clock in the afternoon as it is in July. And I think the environment and the climate certainly lends itself to it, but also because of water and what it means to us as a state. What kinds of things happen in here.
And I guess there's a water polo team practicing as we speak. That's a tough sport too, right? I mean, you've got to have some fitness for that.
No doubt. Water polo is another one of those just grinded out tough sports. Really fun, really exciting, and great for kids that don't necessarily want to go the swimming way. We have got a great club water polo team, and kids really get into anything with a ball, right? So we've got a women's team, we've got a men's team, we've got a mixed team, we've got a junior team, so it's pretty much anything that you want to do. I mean, we have splash ball, which kids can actually put one of those floaty things underneath them so they can float a little better to grab the ball. And so there's all kinds of access to pretty much anything to do with water we have.
Now, one of the things you are heavily into promoting is swim safety and safety around water. And as you say, I mean, this is a watery state, right? So learning to swim is a good idea. What kind of programs do you have going on here to encourage kids to get into the water and be comfortable and safe in the water?
Well, and you're right, it is conducive to having water safety programs, which we have all year long. I mean, specifically May is National Drowning Awareness Month, as we lead in the summer, because most drownings happen during the summer months, obviously, and more drownings happen Memorial Day weekend than any other weekend during the year. So it's kind of an important week for us this week and next, especially when we have Safety Around Water Week, where we are giving free safety lessons to the community itself at almost all of our Ys. And it drives me crazy when I see a child or when I hear about a child drowning. It is a leading cause of unintentional death in children 4 years of age and younger. So it is an epidemic in our country, and I like to feel like we're doing something about it here at the Central Florida Y, certainly in this building and all our Ys across our association. And that's the fact that we found the cure to drowning, and it's swim lesson. You have to put your child in swim lessons. 10 people a day drown in our country, so you have almost 4,000 people a year drown. Florida is the number one state in the country for drowning, and Central Florida itself is second only to South Florida in the number of drownings that happen nationwide.
Where do they happen? Is it happening in pools? Is it happening at the beach?
The drownings happen everywhere. It can happen in a bathtub. It can happen in a bucket. It can happen in a pool, a retention pond, a lake, the ocean. It really doesn't have any kind of boundaries as far as where it can happen. And the really interesting stat is the fact that 80% of those drownings happen right in front of an adult. That means that adult is within 10 feet of that child. And that's because in this age, the adult becomes distracted. So when I talk about putting your child in swim lessons, yes, critical, no doubt about it. But the very first line of defense has to be that adult, has to be that parent. They're the one that have to make sure that child never swims alone.
So for the swim safety, the free swim safety lessons or presentations you're doing, what does that involve exactly?
Well, another stat that's interesting is 70%, well, that stat has gotten a little better. It's 65% now. 65% of African-American children do not know how to swim. 50% of Hispanic children do not know how to swim, but also 40% of Caucasian children don't know how to swim. So my point is, we really want to try to reach out to those underserved communities and say, yes, the number one reason for that statistic is generational fear. The adult is fearful, so they pass that fear down to their child. But the second major reason is access. They don't normally have the access to pools. Well, we have a lot of outreach wise across our association. So really the most important thing is to know that it's out there. It's for everybody. And I think what we want to try to get across is what I'm telling you right now. We want to try to educate parents to say, don't leave your child alone. Don't get on your phone when your child is in the pool. And a lot of these apartment complexes have pools. And the parents sometimes say, yeah, go ahead and go down and take a dip. And they don't know how to swim, or they get in above their water. And drowning is a silent killer. Children don't make noise. Adults don't make noise when they drown. It literally looks like they're playing under the water. And a child can drown in as little as 30 seconds. It can take longer, but in as little as 30 seconds. So it can be in a blink of an eye that a child is gone. And that's what we try to educate parents when they bring their children in. It's not only educating the child, it's also educating the family.
If it happens that quickly and it's silent and there aren't too many signs of it, what do you look out for then if you are paying attention?
Well, the most important thing we tell children is you always have to ask for permission to swim. Regardless of where you're at or what kind of situation, you have to have that adult give you permission to swim. The second thing is the adult has to be that eye on that child. And a lot of times, most of the times, the drownings take place with several adults around the pool, like at a party, and several kids in the pool. It's because everybody else is thinking they're watching their own child, so they're keeping an eye on mine too. So what we're trying to tell parents is there has to be a water watcher. This is a YMCA tradition.
So essentially you've got to have a lifeguard. Like a designated lifeguard.
Literally. That's exactly what you need. And the way we do it is we actually have a badge, and you put that necklace with that badge around your neck, and that makes sure that parent or that adult has that responsibility, and they know they're responsible. Therefore, you know, they're really keeping an eye because they've got that badge on, and if something happened, it's under their watch. So it really puts the responsibility on the adult, and that's something else that we also talk about all week long. when we go through our Safety Around Water Week. I get a Google alert every day when a child drowns, and I get two or three a day, every day.
So this is just like news stories of drownings around the country?
Across the country. I make sure when a child drowning, that's the Google alert I get, and I get them all the time because I want it to be a constant reminder that, you know, my job, at least here in Central Florida, I can't control what happens in Montana, but my job here in Central Florida is to make sure that we try to eradicate this.
Do you feel like you're making some progress then? Are you making some headway with the program you have here at the Y and your outreach to communities where there is a higher rate of drowning?
Yeah, I think we're making a difference. I'll give you an interesting fact. In 2011, the University of Memphis, along with the USA Swimming Foundation, did a study that why people drown, right, and what happens when people drown. And they found that at that time, 70% of African-American children did not know how to swim. Flash forward to 2017, 6 years later, and now that stat is down to 65%. So it has dropped. We're seeing improvement, especially in that category. The 40% of Caucasians has not changed. But we are seeing a lot of improvement in those minority communities, and that's what we're trying to do here at the Y here in Florida, is reach out to those communities. So we're feeling like we're doing the job, but we still have a long way to go. Long way to go.
So what's your goal when it comes to water safety? Do you have like a long-term ambition of getting that number down to a certain level?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I beat myself up pretty much almost every day because I get those Google alerts and I read about the cases and not all of them are unintentional. Some are accidental, meaning they could not be helped. But most are unintentional, meaning they could have been helped. And I guess my goal is to see it completely eradicated. But it's like those other dreaded diseases that we have in our life, when you talk about cancer and heart disease and so many others that have taken people away from us, our loved ones. Will a cure ever happen? In my lifetime, probably not, for cancer. We've all been touched by cancer. And maybe I won't be able to stop drownings altogether. But I got to figure that if I can just, I know this sounds kind of cliche-ish, but if I can just impact a handful that otherwise maybe would have drowned, but instead they had swim lessons, and that provided a huge safety to that child, then I think I've done my job. We have a great program called Safe Start, which is our infant survival swim course that starts at 6 months and goes to 3 years of age. It's incredible. I'll stack it against any other in the country. And it teaches those childs that key safety element of rolling on their back if they fall in the water. And I have 50 letters on my desk that literally said, because of my child taking that course, it saved their lives because I went to go answer the door and my child fell in the water and they were on their back when I got back. And so for that, we're doing a good job, man. We're hanging in there. We're trying to make an impact. We have an incredible partner in Dr. Phillips Charities, which does so much for us. They have funded so much of our Safe Start program and so much about what the YMCA is all about. So with great partners and great advocates, we're gonna make some headway.
And hopefully the AC will be back on in a little while.
It's hotter than Hades in here, isn't it? Yeah. Welcome to summer in Florida, my friend. But I love it. I could be on the deck all day. I never get tired of being on a pool deck, whether it's 100 degrees or 50 degrees. I love it.
Rowdy Gaines is the Vice President of Aquatics for the YMCA of Central Florida. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, buddy. Appreciate you being here.
Still to come on Intersection, building a better spacesuit. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Astronauts on the International Space Station use a specialized suit called the Extravehicular Mobility Unit, or EMU, to work outside the space station safely. The suits were delivered to the station in the 1980s and are in need of an upgrade. The suits made headlines earlier this year when what would have been the first all-female spacewalk was postponed due to a lack of sizing for the innards of one of the EMUs. Florida Today space reporter Antonio Giamillo wrote about the history of the suit, the challenges NASA faces upgrading the equipment, and what the agency is thinking about for a future moon mission suit in a piece published earlier this month. She spoke to 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne.
Thank you for having me, Brendan.
So the story you wrote, it begins back in the 1980s with a fellow named Story Musgrave and his first spacewalk. But we come to find out that astronauts are using the same spacesuits. Bring us back to that moment.
Right. So the same NASA spacesuits that astronauts still use whenever they are conducting spacewalks on the International Space Station are the exact same ones that were used in the space shuttle program back in the 1980s. So technically these suits were actually first flown in 1981, but it wasn't until 1983 when the first space shuttle astronauts conducted their first spacewalk that they were in use. But yeah, they've been around for decades, and even though they have been refurbished and they've been refurbished throughout the years and everything, NASA hasn't upgraded the suits, and now as we head on to go to the moon, they definitely need to up their game.
Now, this has been common knowledge within NASA and within the astronaut corps that these suits were old and in dire need of updating. But the general public kind of got an idea of just how bad the situation was recently when there was supposed to be the first all-female spacewalk and the suits weren't able to accommodate both the spacewalkers. What happened there?
Right. So NASA, the first all-female spacewalk was supposed to happen last March with the NASA astronauts Anne McLean and Christina Koch. And the spacewalk did happen. It was with a female astronaut with Christina Koch and then the male astronaut Nick Hague. The problem was that there just weren't enough sizes or the same suit size available for both female astronauts. They both needed medium-sized suits, and unfortunately there was only one medium-sized suit available for one of the astronauts. The other medium-sized suit aboard the space station would have needed extra time for configuration and test, and that would have just required more hours and delays probably. So they then decided just to replace Anne McLean with Nick Hague. But yes, that caused kind of a whole social media, outburst. People were very upset and everything. And I think it definitely kind of brought this issue into the spotlight because it's because aside from the fact that these suits have been in use for over 30 years, they're also now there just isn't that many available, as was evident during the all-female spacewalk cancellation.
Yeah, and I think we have to take a step back and talk a little bit about the design of the suits to kind of get a better understanding of this. But the issue with the all-female spacewalk was that there were the pieces available, but they weren't installed, because these are kind of like jigsaw puzzles, right? You've got different pieces that connect to each other that create one suit. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, exactly. It's not like just one, outfit that an astronaut puts on. It's a bunch of detachable parts, like you said, like a jigsaw puzzle. So what was the problem was that they didn't have enough medium upper torso, which is essentially the shirt of the spacesuit. And to do that, it's not like, it's not even just putting all these different parts together. There's also, like I said, they have to do a bunch of configuration tests and everything to get them all in the right size and make sure they're safe, because obviously, these spacesuits are vital, for an astronaut whenever they step out into outer space. They need to survive in this thing or else they won't. So it was definitely, there was a risk factor and everything, and that's why then they decided to cancel it. But yes, exactly. It's a bunch of detachable parts so that it could theoretically be able to fit or accommodate many types of body sizes, but with a limited quantity available, then it still ends up preventing some people from being able to wear them.
And we should mention NASA came out after the switch was made and said, this was due to safety, and both the astronauts, understood the risks and challenges, and it was their decision to do this. But I think we should step back again, because you also you interviewed a former astronaut, Winston Scott, in your piece, and these spacesuits just kind of explain their purpose and just what it's like to be inside of one of these, because it doesn't sound very fun from the reporting that I read from your story.
Yeah, no, you're definitely right. When I spoke with Winston, He did say, you know, these spacesuits are necessary to survive in, and because of that, though, they're very bulky, and he made sure kind of to emphasize, you know, they're very bulky and massive and everything, so they're heavy and uncomfortable to wear, and also, since they're a bunch of detachable parts, they aren't custom made for any astronauts like the spacesuits that were during the Gemini and Apollo programs. So because of that, there have been many issues, you know, with astronauts who wear the spacesuits. One of the main ones is kind of is aligning the joints with the suit itself. I mean, being able to just bend your hand is a problem for the astronauts whenever they wear these NASA spacesuits. And that was one of the things that Winston Scott always had a problem with, and many other astronauts as well throughout the years.
Yeah, they're kind of like mini space ships themselves, right? So that comes with its own set of challenges.
Exactly. Yes. I guess the best way to describe it, and the way that either, you know, the NASA scientists or the actual astronauts themselves describe it is a little mini spacecraft in itself. I mean, this is the first kind of line of defense that the astronaut has to protect them from the vacuum of space. And because of that, then there are a lot of things that are required to make sure that they can help, you know, keep the astronauts safe. But unfortunately, then it also comes with a lot of problems and issues because it's not very comfortable. And that's the main thing that Winston kept, you know, reinforcing or reiterating, is that yes, you know, these spacesuits are necessary, they're vital, the astronauts need them, but they aren't that comfortable, and they should be updated, they should be, you know, better equipped to help, you know, serve the astronauts' need and help them, you know, do their work better, as opposed to, you know, restraining them from doing certain functions like being able to bend your hand or move your arm or bend your knee.
And through your reporting for this piece for Florida Today, you uncovered a handful of challenges in upgrading these, you know, three decades plus suits. I mean, what are some of the, you know, the hurdles that NASA faces in trying to upgrade these extravehicular suits?
Well, I mean, just when it comes to upgrading, I mean, the problem is that, you know, NASA has already known for years that they need to upgrade their suits. And back when they had the Constellation program or other programs, you know, for deep space exploration missions, NASA was also then trying then to have then the appropriate suit size for those missions. But because then those programs either got canceled or just a lack of funding, they were never able then to get developed. And also one of the main problems has been there has never been a clear indication for the agency to know then, okay, which program are we going to be going to? Because it's not even just that the spacesuits right now, you know, aren't even that great for the astronauts who are currently using them. They also wouldn't be able to work for the next astronauts to go to the lunar surface or to go to another celestial body. And that's one of the things that NASA has always said. I mean, each suit is kind of designed for its own particular mission. So before, when NASA then didn't even have a clear idea of then which mission, which program they were going to be doing, it was hard then to develop the appropriate suit for that because they didn't know the restraints or the limitations or the appropriate measures they would need to make sure that this suit would be ready and perfect, you know, for the astronaut.
And another challenge you write about in the piece is that there really wasn't a supplier to bring the old suits back or send new suits up, right? These are big, bulky, very sensitive pieces of machinery, and there really aren't that many supply lines up to the space station, right?
Yes, exactly. Ever since the space shuttle program retired in 2011, that has also has unfortunately also prevented, you know, being able to then bring down the spacesuits and bring them back up to the International Space Station and refurbish them because yes, they don't have now that many suppliers to carry them to the ISS, and so that's been another issue. And then also some of the suits, the backpack, you know, kind of life support system that allows, you know, the astronaut to breathe and survive in their spacesuit. A few of them have also gotten destroyed in the Columbian Challenger disaster or in the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket that exploded a few years ago. And so that's also then caused limitations because now there's a limited quantity available and they can't even then bring them down and bring them back up to the bring them back up to space in as frequently as they would like.
And you also mentioned this earlier in our conversation, is that these spacesuits are designed for a lot of work in a very harsh environment, but also to accommodate a wide number of astronauts. So the first spacesuits were designed for an astronaut corps in the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs, which there weren't that many astronauts. But now, as the space program continues, there's a lot more people going to space. So the suits have to be able to accommodate the dozens of different people that might, you know, throw them on, right?
Yes, exactly. And I believe that was... you know, one of the main problems and concerns and why people were very upset on social media when, you know, Anne McLean and Christina Koch weren't able to conduct the all-female spacewalk together because you're right, now the whole point of having these new NASA spacesuits, of having them be like these detachable parts that fit together like a puzzle, was to accommodate more people of different body sizes and everything. But it hasn't really worked out due to, you know, a lack of funding and then budget cuts. And, you know, before there used to be extra large, large, medium, small, and extra small sizes, but now there are only medium, large, and extra large. So that also then prevents, you know, some astronauts of smaller body shapes of being able then to conduct the spacewalks. And so definitely, though, as the NASA astronaut class continues to grow and you see more and more diversity and just people of all different body shapes and sizes, they're going to have to find a way to make sure that these suits can actually, you know, fit a wide range of people.
So what's the plan moving forward, Antonia? What have you found out from engineers and NASA leaders about the plan for the next generation of spacesuits and the next generation of astronauts?
Well, I mean, there are definitely, you know, ideas out there, and NASA's looking at all of them. But the agency, I mean, still right now, they from what they told me, they're still looking at all the options, you know, internal options or external options. I know at FIT, though, they actually one of the professors, his name's Andre Giduli, he and several classmates, they helped kind of create their own version of a spacesuit, and it wouldn't actually look like a suit, but it would be, in a way, it would kind of be better because it would be a mini spaceship, an actual mini spaceship with these detachable robotic arms outside, where one astronaut can go inside it, and then the robotic arms would be providing and performing all the functions that are needed to repair the International Space Station, and that way, you know, anyone could fit into this spaceship. It doesn't matter, you know, if you are 6 foot tall or 5 foot tall or anything, because it's meant to accommodate anyone. And so that's one option, but also that was mainly just for a competition and everything. So I'm not saying that NASA is actually looking at that, but then the agency is also, they are investing, you know, in this smart suit is what they're calling it, which would, you know, help provide, you know, these soft robotics technologies that allow astronauts to kind of better interact with their surroundings. And one of the cool functions about the smart suit is that it actually supposedly has, you know, self-healing skin. So if they were to get injured, the suits would actually heal them. But that's also in a very experimental phase right now. So I'm not even sure if that's going to continue or if the agency is going to further, you know, continue to provide funding for this. but it is an option. And then when I also spoke to Winston, he said he would like a kind of an Iron Man version of a spacesuit. I mean, honestly, I think that would be really fun too. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. As of right now, though, NASA still they're still looking at all the options, and time is ticking.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, time is ticking because there is this new charge to put humans on the surface of the moon by 2024. Which means they're going to need another spacesuit for that. So, I mean, is this looking like it's going to happen in time?
That's a really good question. And honestly, I mean, if NASA wants to meet this goal, and they seem like they do, I mean, every time, you know, Jim Bridenstine, you know, the NASA administrator, says that we are going to go to the moon by 2024, and, you know, we will put the next man and woman, then they're going to make sure they need to have the appropriate spacesuit, because the ones they currently have won't work. And in a recent meeting last month, you know, Bridenstine and also Bill Gerstenmaier, they had spoken and said that they will have a spacesuit available for the astronauts so that when they land on the lunar surface, they can actually walk on the moon. But they haven't provided any details as to what that is. And like I said, when I spoke with the agency, they said they're still looking at options. So I think it really just depends. If they're able to pull it off, then maybe. But I don't know if it's their main concern, or if their main concern is other, you know, other pieces of equipment that are also needed to get to the moon, like the Space Launch System or the Orion spacecraft. And so I guess really only time will tell.
And we should mention Bill Gerstenmaier is the head of human exploration efforts for NASA. There is quite a few things on NASA's checklist for a mission to the moon, and spacesuits is one of them. Definitely check out Antonia's piece in Florida Today that published earlier this month. Antonia Jaramillo is the space reporter at Florida Today. Antonia, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. It was great speaking to you too, Brendan.
Still to come, what three new toll roads across Florida would mean for the environment. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Governor Ron DeSantis has been welcomed by environmental advocates for his commitment to Everglades restoration, but now a bill signed by the governor giving the green light to a trio of new toll roads is raising the alarm.
Charles Lee is the Director of Advocacy for Audubon of Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to.
One piece of legislation out of the session this year authorizes three new toll roads. Quite a lot of controversy around these roads and some concerns about what they would do to the environment if they were built. I wonder if you could just lay out what the concerns of Audubon of Florida might be there.
Well, obviously, any time a major road is built, it has negative environmental implications. And we've been dealing with that a lot in Central Florida. And it was dealt with over more than a decade in the process that surrounded the ultimate design of the Wekiva Parkway. And anytime you have a road that comes close to a treasured resource like the Wekiva River, or in the case of the Heartland Parkway component of these three toll roads authorized by the legislature, something that will go through areas of scrub, areas of wetland, potentially areas that are involved with species like the Florida grasshopper sparrow. You have a high level of risk and concern.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have the broader concern about roads opening up areas to a spurt of development that local governments do not have the capability of controlling.
So the roads span from Collier County to Polk County, or the proposed roads, Collier County to Polk County, Citrus County to Jefferson County, and from the northern end of the Florida Turnpike to the Suncoast Parkway. Talk to me a little bit about these regions. Like, what do they look like now, and what is significant about them environmentally?
Well, from the Polk County area south to Collier County, you're crossing a wide variety of habitats. You're going through almost all very rural lands, lands that are characterized by primarily ranching mm-hmm. and other agricultural pursuits, but ranching would be the highest number of acres in those areas. You also have a diversity of ecosystems. You have scrub. You have pineland. You cross rivers like Fish-Eating Creek. You cross rivers like the Caloosahatchee River. As you get south of the Caloosahatchee River, you rapidly get into the western edge of the Everglades. And areas such as the Ocalaway-Coochee Slough, potentially the Corkscrew Swamp area where Audubon has a sanctuary of well over 10,000 acres, areas that are under planning for use as part of the Everglades restoration mm-hmm. May be involved as you move south. So there's a lot at issue.
How many of these areas have some protection on them already? Like you mentioned, the Audubon area is protected, right? And that last piece of land you mentioned.
Well, Audubon owns it.
Mm, right.
But that doesn't mean that a transportation agency couldn't condemn through it.
Right.
And you have a large acreage of land that is owned by various agencies for conservation purposes, both state agencies and federal agencies. And you've also got land that is privately owned, but where the owner has sold an easement to perpetually dedicate that land to conservation and to guarantee that the land would never be developed. Mm-hmm. And a substantial amount of easement acreage could be encountered by this road as well.
I guess the argument on the pro side of the roads would be, look, we have this massive population growth in Florida, right? People have to live somewhere, and it's kind of inevitable that some areas are going to be developed and people need to get around. So what sort of arguments do you put up against those arguments for building more roads, building more development in some of these areas?
Well, whether or not the roads are needed for that purpose, I think is something that is yet ahead of us in terms of a determination. There clearly were people in the legislative leadership who thought so. Mm-hmm. The bill that they passed does not make a determination that there will be these roads. The bill that they passed makes a determination to start a process involving three task forces to look at the pluses and the minuses and to also look at how, if a road is to be recommended, it should be designed to go through the area mm-hmm. and the route the road will take. The study process in the task forces will undoubtedly begin with a broad envelope of lands and then will narrow to a small line on a map as it progresses. But I think we're as concerning, and it should be of concern, as the advent of three proposals for new toll roads in these areas are. Mm-hmm. I think we're fortunate that some provisions were put in this legislation that will make sure, one, that there's a very careful screening as to whether the road should be built at all, and two, to create a guarantee, if you will, that there will be something similar to the process that unfolded in the case of the Wekiva River if these roads go forward. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the Wekiva River, we ended up with an environmentally superior design.
You're talking about the Wekiva Parkway.
The Wekiva Parkway. Mm-hmm. We ended up with a design that, to a large extent, did not put in a new road at all, but rather relied upon the refurbishment of an existing road, State Road 46. Mm-hmm. And the Wekiva Parkway will essentially replace and lay down on top of the area that's already been interrupted by State Road 46. That was one of the more important environmental achievements that came out of the Wekiva Task Force that led to the passage of legislation in 2004 creating the Wekiva Parkway. Mm-hmm. And so what has happened in the legislation that has just passed, Senate Bill 7068, is that they have attempted to take from the Wekiva process that Governor Bush created in an executive order and to make that the foundation of how DOT will go forward in the case of these three roads. And if they are going to look at building these three roads, that's certainly the way they should do it.
Charles Lee, just thinking about the Wekiva Parkway, though, did you have consensus from all environmental groups, or are there still some who say this should never have been built?
Well, I think you can probably find some people out there today who would say that it should never have been built. And it's kind of hard to answer that question, because when you use the phrase from some environmental groups, you know, anybody is free to go down to the Secretary of State's office and file a set of papers and create their own new environmental group tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to kind of judge that as a filter. But what is fact is that the Wekiva Parkway is nearing completion in construction, and it'll be built. It'll finish up sometime in the year 2022, and there was not one permit challenge. There was not one environmental group that went to court. There was not one environmental objection that rose after the passage of the legislation to attempt to stand in the way of the product, if you will, of better than 2 years of task force deliberation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you would hope that if they decided to press ahead with new toll roads, environmental groups such as Audubon would have a seat at the table in deciding how to go ahead with that?
Well, that's I can't say who's going to actually be the environmental spokespersons that are on each of the three task forces, mm-hmm. because that's a decision that will be made by the Secretary of DOT. But the legislation clearly instructs the Secretary of DOT to have members from Audubon and the Sierra Club and 1,000 Friends of Florida and Florida Wildlife Corridor and the Everglades Foundation and others, who organizations such as that will have seats on the task force.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, the governor DeSantis putting his signature on this bill, how does it kind of fit into the picture you're building up of this governor and his environmental approach, or his approach to the environment and things that have an impact on our environment in Florida?
Well, I think you have to judge a governor by the cumulative result of what they do. Clearly, in this legislative session, the governor has brought a tremendous amount of benefit to environmental restoration in Florida. I think a lot of environmentalists were disappointed that he signed this bill. I understand why he signed it. And I think the reason that he did sign it was because if you read the bill from the first page to the last page, you quickly realize that the bill does not require or ordain the blind construction of three roads, mm-hmm. but rather it puts into place a process that is going to evaluate whether those roads should be built, and if you do build those roads, what should you do to offset the damage? And interestingly, one of the features of this bill is quite environmental in its nature, and that it establishes as a basic purpose of these corridors the protection and enhancement of environmentally sensitive areas and wildlife corridors. It also establishes as another basic purpose of these corridors the protection and enhancement of springs protection areas and farmland preservation areas that have been designated by local governments in their comprehensive plans. Mm-hmm. And so that's, if you read what the outcome is supposed to be along with a potential road, another outcome of co-equal weight in that list are those environmentally protective features. And then there's a later provision relating to the task force that says that the task forces can recommend the acquisition of land for environmental purposes and restoration, the acquisition of easements and things like that, and that in conjunction with the Department of Transportation, DOT is, in conjunction with recommendations from the Department of Environmental Regulation, mm-hmm. DOT is instructed to make those components part of the project plan, which means that potentially significant environmental acquisitions may be funded along with the construction of these roads if the roads ever go forward.
Having said all that, though, are you still disappointed that the governor signed the bill?
I think the governor carefully balanced and analyzed what was in front of him. I'm disappointed more that the initial thrust to build these roads was made when many thinkers about the future of Florida believe that what we should be doing is we should be focusing on the resolution of congestion on places like I-75, mm-hmm. Interstate 4, our urban areas. There are clearly two philosophies in the legislature. One of them is to support transportation funding in urban areas to relieve that congestion, but another group of legislators who happen to be the ones who are most in power this year believe we should be pushing new roads through rural areas. Not something that I personally support or believe in, but again, I'm not in the legislature voting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the governor was faced with this bill, which on one hand created the prospect of these roads, but on the other hand created a very desirable screening process from an environmental standpoint for the roads to go through before they are authorized. And so it was clearly something that the governor would have had to weigh both sides of the question before he decided whether to sign or veto.
On that theme of development and growth, lawmakers in the state budget approved putting $33 million towards land conservation. That's down from about $300 million in past decades. Do you think that's enough money for land conservation? Would you have liked to see more?
Of course. No, it's not enough money. And, of course, we would have liked to have seen significantly more. I think eventually we will have more, although one thing that needs to be recognized is that that $33 million is not the full extent of what Florida Forever will be mm-hmm. as we move into the next fiscal year, because with the carryover money from the past years, the available funds to acquire land will be well over $100 million. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, no, it is not enough. We used to have a program in Florida that funded land acquisition at $300 million a year. If I had my druthers, that's about where I would like to see the funding at. But again, the priorities of the legislature change as years go by. And those of us that are trying to advance things and get things done in the legislature have got to work with legislators and be collaborative rather than standing on the outside and protesting.
And do you feel like you at Audubon have the ear of this governor and can work with this governor, if not other lawmakers?
So far, the results are good.
Charles Lee, Director of Advocacy with Audubon of Florida, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.